Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How is the shifting balance between rural and urban populations changing China? And what does it take for migrant workers to truly succeed after leaving their home villages in search of greater opportunity? China's urban population has doubled following a wave of government reforms 30 years ago, and it's expected to be twice the current amount in another 30. But while rural residents are drawn to the jobs in China's big cities, migrants are denied full citizenship rights in those boom towns and often find they lack the skills and education to earn the kind of money that could truly change their lives. Michelle Damon-Loyalka is a freelance journalist who has observed all of this and come to know people affected over the course of her 13 years living in China. She writes about it in her new book, Eating Bitterness, Stories from the Front Lines of China's Great Urban Migration. Michelle, welcome to Think.
Thanks so much, Chris. It's great to be here.
I have to tell you, it's really hard to get a handle on the way China's cities are growing. But by 2025, demographers expect it to have well over 200 cities with at least a million people and 15 with more than 25 million.
That's right. It's such an amazing scope and also the pace that it's happening. I mean, right now there's 160 cities with a million people. So that's been 20 years, a scope of 20 years, almost another 100 cities will have a million people.
How does the Chinese government regulate the movement of rural residents into urban areas?
Well, you know, originally they restricted it very tightly. So China has what's called the Hukou system or the household registration system. And they've had some version of this on and off for the last 2,000 years. But the most recent sort of reincarnation of it came in the late 50s when Mao instituted it as a way to stop the rural residents from fleeing the countryside after collectivized agriculture began. Mm-hmm. And so essentially at that time, if you wanted to leave your village, you need to have a whole host of official permissions and documents. And even people within cities had to have this sort of documentation in order to move from city to city. So at that time, movement was really tightly controlled using this household registration system. Now, today they don't, it's still in place, but it isn't used to control movement so much. Today, China really needs, actually, they need people to come from the countryside into the cities because, again, when they're urbanizing at such a dramatic pace, they need people to come and, you know, build up the buildings and lay down the roads and work in the new shops and restaurants. And the whole sort of urban life in China right now really depends on this influx of rural labor. So the government is actually in large part encouraging migration at this point. They're not using this registration system to stop people from moving.
Let's talk about your title, Eating Bitterness. It's the approximate English translation of a Chinese term that you feel like applies to a lot of the country's rural poor.
Oh, absolutely. So in China, there's this great word. It's churku, and it really has it has several kind of ideas rolled up in one. So essentially, it's this ability to endure difficulties, to persevere through hardships, and to sort of continue on and press ahead in the face of whatever problems may arise. And also, I think it has this kind of idea of not stopping to complain or to say, you know, that whatever I have to deal with isn't fair, but sort of enduring, I guess. And in English, there's not one word that can sort of sum all of this up in one term. So if we translate it directly, it comes out to eating bitterness. And, you know, this has been a long-held value in Chinese culture, but I think especially if we look over the last century, there's been a lot of upheaval in China. And I think that this ability to sort of bear down and endure has really been kind of honed to a new level. And I didn't start off with this as a theme for the book when I first started doing research, but as I talked with so many different migrants, they themselves brought it up over and over again as this ability of to eat bitterness being sort of the key to their being able to survive in the cities when they face a lot of difficulties there. And also, I think it's been a key to China's own ability to developed so quickly over the last 30 years that they have this labor force they can rely on that's not just, you know, extremely large and relatively low cost, but also very resolute and sort of able to kind of endure whatever comes up. And this has been a kind of a key kind of a hidden secret to China's development in the last 30 years.
And in many cases, people are willing to endure because they're thinking not about themselves, but about the next generation, their kids.
Absolutely, absolutely. So a lot of the migrants that I talk to, you know, if you ask them, what is your goal in the cities, they'll say, it's to make sure that my kids don't have to live this sort of tired existence that I have. A lot of migrants will have relatively low education, and their biggest goal, I think, is to make sure that their kids can get more education than they can. And it actually puts them in a very kind of strange situation. They have to make some very interesting choices. You know, there's a family, for example, the woman leaves her two children back in the village with relatives, and she herself comes to the city to take care of a rich family's two kids. So she becomes a nanny. And, you know, the way she said it to me is, I had a choice, essentially. I could either stay with my kids and not have money for their future and for their education, or I could leave my kids and not have the opportunity to raise them, but I could make the money that they'll need for their futures. And so I think this is the kind of common dilemma that a lot of people face, and in the end they decide that coming to the cities and taking work, making the money for their kids' future is more important than, I don't know if they would say more important, but it's the choice that they have to make and kind of forfeit that opportunity to raise their kids.
You know, that story really struck a chord with me, certainly as a parent, but this woman who works as a nanny, she's got a teenage daughter who, like teenage daughters all over the world, turns out to be sort of ungrateful and just resentful right. That her mom's not around.
Yeah, absolutely. It's interesting because I think about that. I mean, I can't put myself in the place of these kids, obviously, but definitely it's hard. But there is, in China, there's entire villages where essentially the only people in the village are under age 18 or over age, say, 50, 55. Everybody who's of working age has gone out to the cities as a migrant. And so I think that it's hard on the kids, but I think it's so normal in the countryside that it's probably a bit easier than, say, if, you know, an American parent decided to do that same thing and left their kids behind. I think because it's not the social norm here, it would be probably much harder on those kids.
It is ironic that when she goes to her home village, this woman who, you know, her kids are upset with her for leaving, but she is really considered to be someone who's made it for herself, and she's quite respected.
Yeah, that's right. You know, as a nanny, she works as a nanny for a rich family, and so whenever they travel, they take her with them. And so she's had the opportunity to, you know, fly around the country and to stay at, you know, really nice hotels and eat at fancy restaurants and all of these things that most villagers have never had the opportunity to do. And so for her kids, that becomes something of bragging rights. You know, they can tell their friends that my mom has been on an airplane. My mom has, you know, gone to these vacation spots and these different things. And in the village, people don't know, you know, what her financial situation is, but they look at her life and they assume, wow, she's really sort of, she's really made it, and she's really kind of a model for a lot of people back in the village then.
She also deals with something that is common, I know, to, you know, domestic workers in a lot of situations, which is that behavior that she would never tolerate from her own children. She has to sort of suck up and take from the apparently very spoiled charges that she's paid to care for.
Yeah, that's right. And it was interesting because when I talked with her and her husband, you know, it was a really interesting contrast because there was one time when we went to this vacation villa of the rich family that she works for, and their two kids were there, but also it was her own daughter, the nanny's own daughter, had come from the countryside, and she was also there, so that you could see this real difference in the way the two kids were behaving, the kids from the city and the kids from the countryside. And they both said, you know, we think that the way that village kids act is much better. You know, they're more respectful, they're quiet, they know how to, you know, be obedient. And it's definitely sort of a contradiction, I think, for her in her life.
Most of the people that you profile for this book are residents of a sort of village that existed right next to the tech district in this one of these big boom towns. Tell us about that smaller community and also about the city that surrounds it.
Sure. So this is actually a very common phenomenon in China. It's called city village. So what happens is as a city sort of, you know, develops and sort of keeps buying up more land, the local government will buy up farmland, but they don't buy up the cluster of village houses, because in China, most villages are designed such that the houses are all clustered together, and then the farmland is sort of spread out around the houses. So city planners will buy up the farmland, but they generally don't buy up these village houses. And so what happens is that those villagers, you know, they used to be farmers, now they have no land, but they get paid for their land, and so they use at least a portion of that money typically to build onto their houses, or sometimes even, you know, destroy their houses and just start again. They build up it as high as the local governments will allow. So in this particular village, I think they capped it at about 4 stories. But in some places, you'll see them building 9-story homes. And essentially, they become landlords. So when rural migrants sort of rush into the area looking for opportunities in the new urban areas that they're building, those migrants can't afford to live in the cities. And so they rent out rooms from these former farmers who have now turned into landlords. And so it's a really common situation in China. And this is also sort of the way that China has avoided the sort of absolute poverty, urban slums that you see in other countries. And so I was living in Xi'an at the time, and Xi'an has this high-tech zone that was built on the land of this village called Ganjiajiai. And from my window, I could see at any time 10 to 20 cranes on the horizon where they're building up new high-rises. But at the same time, I could see this old village right, it was basically right behind my housing complex. And originally, this village was home to about 1,500 farmers, and now it was packed with, they estimate, about 30,000 rural migrants. And this is about five block area. So, you know, it's really highly, the population density was super high. It was not very sanitary. It had been built up sort of haphazardly. Lots of, you know, safety issues and things in that village. But this is, and those migrants, essentially, they live in this village, but then they will work in the high-tech zone. And so they really have to navigate between these two very different worlds. And so the book tries to sort of show how successfully, or in, you know, some cases how unsuccessfully, they're able to navigate between these two different worlds, and also how successfully, or again in some cases unsuccessfully, they're able to sort of integrate into urban society.
Well, and you say they work in the high-tech zone, but they are not, by and large, working in high-tech jobs, because rural educations, which is what most of them have had, don't compare with what one would get in a city.
Yeah, absolutely. They're snapping up the low-paying, sort of distasteful jobs that urbanites are not very interested in, or if a lot of them also do their own type of business, oftentimes very low-level, sort of hauling loads or selling things on the back of bicycles, selling fruit, things like this. And you're absolutely right about the education. So, you know, in China, if we look at education, a lot of, there's compulsory education only through junior high. So through 9th grade, everyone's guaranteed to have access to education. But after that, you have to test into high school, and then you have to test into college. And so only about 40% of people, at least in poor counties in rural China, are able to go on to education beyond junior high. And in fact, a lot of youth are dropping out of junior high because they see that there's these, for them, what looks like high-paying jobs for migrant workers in the cities. But of course, right now, migrant salaries have gone up quite a bit, but obviously over the course of their lifetime, they're not going to rise as fast as, say, a high school or college graduate salaries would rise. And so this is a big challenge for China right now, is how to encourage more countryside youth to stay in school and to acquire the skills that they're going to need as China continues to develop.
My guest is freelance journalist Michelle Damon-Loyalka. Her new book is called Eating Bitterness, Stories from the Front Lines of China's Great Urban Migration. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can send an email to think@kera.org, or you can call in to 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in financial planning, web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. And you can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalist Michelle Damon-Loyalka. Her new book is called Eating Bitterness, Stories from the Front Lines of China's Great Urban Migration. You can be part of the conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. Michelle, without necessarily meaning to, I think it's common for a lot of Americans to fall into sort of a monolithic understanding of what China is. But in fact, by region, it varies a great deal. Now, Xi'an is in the western part of the country?
That's right.
Okay.
That's right.
And what's different there from the coastal regions in the east?
Well, it's very interesting because when China first started to do its reform and opening 30 years ago, it had this concept that it would first allow, you know, a small part of the population to become prosperous, and then that those people would sort of pull up the rest of the country to prosperity. And so the western seaboard of China was essentially chosen to be the leaders toward prosperity. And western China was essentially neglected, just kind of left to sort of languish behind. And so now when we see reports about China, generally we're seeing Beijing, Shanghai, Guangdong province, or this sort of the boom towns on the eastern seaboard. But Western China, by contrast, you know, it's the ancient capital of China. So Xi'an was actually the capital of China for quite a long time in the past. And most people probably know it as being the home of the Terracotta Soldiers, which is a pretty big tourist spot in China. But also, it's the cradle of Chinese civilization, and it's where Mao sort of staged his communist revolution from. And so it has a lot of history and culture there. Over the last three decades, it's really been left behind. And so in 2000, the government started what's called the Great Opening of the West policy. And this essentially, I think at that point, they realized, you know, the gap between Western and Eastern China is, you know, so severe that something needed to be done. And so this policy was designed to bring the Western part of China up to speed with the East. And you see now that the East has developed to such a degree that a lot of places, the cost of living is so high now that, one, migrants aren't so willing to go there anymore, and two, a lot of factories and companies are finding it a bit unaffordable. So we're seeing now a migration of businesses and factories sort of headed towards Western China. And Western China, since that policy started in 2000, that was when I was in Xi'an, and Xi'an at that time was sort of the focal point of this developing of the West policy. And again, like I had said earlier, you could see just 20 buildings going up on the horizon at any given time. It was such a massive sort of city building process in such a quick amount of time. And this has been going on now for about 12 years. So I think that the infrastructure is now in place, the sort of office buildings and everything that is needed is kind of in place. So I think China is really Western China is really poised now to sort of become the new face of China. It's the ancient face, and I think it'll become now again the new face of China, and we'll be hearing a lot more about it in the coming years.
Let's go to the phones now. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. We have Kevin on the line in Dallas. Hello, Kevin.
Hi, how are you doing?
Very well, thanks.
I have a question about inflation, and particularly food price inflation, and how that can be sort of a ticking time bomb that might derail this entire development model and potentially even the political regime as they just lose control of the peasant, the huge 900 million odd peasant population. I'll take my answer off the air. Many thanks.
Thanks for your call.
Yeah, inflation is a serious problem. Migrants that I've talked to, they really cite this as a serious problem. I think migrant salaries went up about 20% last year. But on average, but a lot of migrant salaries did not go up at the rate of inflation. And so this is a serious problem that the government's trying to face. In my own life, we have a housekeeper that has worked with us over 4 years. And I think last year, she really enjoys being with our family. She basically said, I need my salary to be doubled or I can't really stay. And that's, I think last year especially, was really common that salaries rose so much. But again, inflation also went up so much that it is a ticking time bomb in a lot of ways. A lot of issues with the migrant population, I think, are ticking time bombs. And that is why in China, I've heard a lot of government leaders in different bureaus sort of saying that issues revolving around migration are their key sort of challenge that they're facing in the coming decade and beyond. And if they can't sort of if they can't sort of take care of the inequalities that the migrants are facing, whether it's in terms of education or lack of access to health care or labor law practices or having a basic minimum wage, then this is a time bomb.
There's also just not a lot of security for these folks. And you write about one family in which the parents earn their living by selling vegetables in an open-air market. And at one point, the people who control the market say, well, we're going to renovate, and so don't come to work. And for an indefinite period of time, they just can't do anything.
That's right. I mean, there's a lot of sort of unfair things that happen to them, and they have no control over that. They are entrepreneurs in a way, but yeah, the market closed down for an indefinite period of time, and didn't really tell them what to expect. And they had a whole load of vegetables that just went to waste as well because they didn't give them forewarning that it was going to close. I think this is pretty common, this sort of labor law and injustices that they face. It is pretty common, definitely.
You also write about an illiterate man who is a father of several children, and he's reached his 60s, and he sharpens knives to make a living, but he's very much at the mercy of anybody who chooses to hire him, including the fact that he has to sort of accept whatever they decide they're going to pay.
That's right. He, in his story especially, he is sort of a throwback to China's older days. You know, he came out as a migrant 20 years ago, and at that time, people like him were the norm. I mean, most migrants were doing some sort of small-time peddling. Oftentimes, he arrived in the city one day, and the very same day he could start to work. He didn't need to have any sort of business licenses or any sort of registration or anything like that. He essentially bought a grinding stone and started to walk around the city selling, sharpening knives. And he is at the mercy of the people that temporarily employ him, and oftentimes there's a lot of haggling that goes on. And for him especially, though, it doesn't really seem to bother him too much. He's lived through a lot of hardship in his life. He went through, the Great Leap Forward and starvation that happened after that, and he went through the whole era of collectivization, and he was allocated to work in a brick factory in a very dangerous job. And so for him, he hasn't had a lot of choices or options in his life, and so when he meets with these kind of things, it's kind of small. As he says, in Xi'an there is no such thing as eating bitterness. He lived through all these really hard days, and so any difficulty that comes up to him seems quite minor.
Another chapter profiles some young women who are trying to make a living selling beauty treatments and beauty products, and it's not so much that they are dying for these jobs in particular, but not much else is available to them given, once again, the level of education they've had.
That's right. So these girls represent a totally new generation of migrants. In China, there's a term for people who are born after 1980. It's called the after 80s generation, and so they've essentially grown up only during China's economic recovery times, and so they haven't really had to endure the deprivation of previous generations, and so they have a different set of expectations. I mean, they're willing to eat bitterness, but only with the kind of clear expectation of it being a temporary means to a more comfortable end. And so these girls come to Xi'an right out of junior high, so 15 years old, and they found jobs in this beauty center. And the beauty center essentially is always sort of dangling this vision of a bright future for them, this vision that they could have a house and a car and kind of fully integrate into urban society if they work hard and kind of work their way up through the ranks and become managers in this company. And the girls are very eager to sort of attain these dreams, but they really don't have any confidence in their ability to do it. And they have no idea really how to go about doing it. And so they kind of live with this underlying fear that if they don't figure things out and sort of get their act together, they may be forced to go back to the countryside. I mean, there may not be a long-term future for them given the fact that they have low education and they're from the countryside.
Of course, the goods and services they're selling didn't have a market until recently when there was this growing middle class with at least some disposable income.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's this really interesting scene where I went back with them, with three of the girls to one of their villages, and her mother looks at the girls who are all kind of made up and wearing, very modern clothes, and the mother says, I'm glad my daughter works in this beauty salon. I think it's good for her. She's changed a lot since she took that job on. You know, she has a different way of thinking, and she has a different way of speaking, and she looks very different. She doesn't look like she's from the countryside anymore. But at the same time, the mother says, but I have no idea what she does there. Hmm. She says it's putting things on people's faces, but, you know, we villagers would never put something on our face like that. And so it's just a really interesting thing. Even the girl's own mother can't really understand what she's doing in the countryside. Yet the mother feels happy that she has this job and that the girl has changed. And the mother also, you know, at the end she says that a lot of kids from the countryside, they go out to the cities for a while, but in the end they end up coming back and having kids and kind of coming back to the villages. And she, you know, feels really sad that her daughter, that may happen to her daughter as well, because I think there is a level of abasement that people who are still in the countryside feel. China is developing so quickly, and largely people in the countryside, I think, feel kind of left behind in that regard. And so she hopes that her daughter can find a future in Xi'an and not have to come back to the village.
Yeah, what are the prospects like for marriage? I mean, there must be, I'm sure, a number of young men with different kinds of jobs that come from the country and end up in cities like Xi'an.
Right. So I think, I don't know any statistics about this, but I think generally probably young migrants end up meeting other young migrants.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's definitely class divide. It's not too common that, a migrant will probably marry a college graduate or something. Although that is sort of the option that these girls often talk about, is this the marriage option. Because in China, if you want to sort of permanently become an urban resident, as I mentioned before, that there's this household registration system that really makes urban and rural not just adjectives, but legal definitions. And the only way to really change your definition, the easiest way at least, is to go to college. Mm-hmm. But again, a lot of people from the countryside don't have the opportunity to go to college. And so the kind of the next best way that these girls see, at least, is to marry somebody who is a college grad, to marry somebody who has this urban registration, and then they can, you know, also integrate into city life with their spouse. But I don't know how common that is.
Well, it is interesting, the story that you tell of the woman who's a nanny, the couple she works for, the woman, the wife of that couple, in fact, grew up in the countryside and sort of prides herself on the fact that no one can tell that she's walking down the street. No one would guess that she hadn't been born in a big city. And yet it's something that she'll refer back to at certain times.
Yeah, she does. She uses that oftentimes when her kids are kind of acting up and very spoiled. She'll tell them, you know, back when I was growing up in the village, there was only one TV in the village, and everybody would stand outside of it, and you were so far away you couldn't even see what was on the TV, but you felt so happy just to be there. She often uses these kind of stories from her past to keep her kids in line or to try to give them perspective on life.
Would spoiled kids in China be recognizable to people who know spoiled kids in the U.S.?
I think so, at least for young kids now growing up in wealthy urban families. I think so. I felt her kids were spoiled. Watching them, yeah.
Talk about this. You end the book with the story of this young man who inarguably has been like wildly successful. He is what everybody dreams of when they go to the city, and most people never get anywhere close. But he's not so happy.
That's right. So he was a second grade dropout and also a runaway. And when he came to Xi'an at age, well, he's 32 at the time when I talked to him in the book, but he had come to Xi'an about 5 years before that, essentially penniless. And in those 5 years, he kind of amassed a small empire of convenience stores and became extremely wealthy. But yeah, he finds himself quite unhappy, you know, isolated and lonely and really feeling like there's not much purpose in life. And he has this desire to turn his sights, you know, away from just his own progress and do some sort of philanthropy, but nobody around him can understand this sort of desire, and he doesn't feel like he has any support in that way. And to me, I was really drawn to his story, not because of just the level of success that he attained, but because I feel like he's representative of the direction that modern China is headed. You know, when China started to reform 30 years ago, people really had the mindset that first, you have to develop materially, you have to, you know, establish your material foundation, and then you can think about everything else. And so, you know, this is largely even still the mindset that people have today, that you have to first make material progress. And so everything else that wasn't sort of material progress is seen as a distraction. But obviously, you know, in the last 30 years, China has developed tremendously, and there are a lot of people like this man who have met or even exceeded their sort of, you know, wildest dreams for their future. And so there's a real sort of restlessness that's starting to set in when people feel like, okay, now what? Now what's the next step? And so we're seeing a real rise in things that before were seen as distractions, like religion, like social activism, environmentalism, philanthropy. All of these things are on the rise in China. And I don't think that rural migrants are ever going to become as, you know, most rural migrants are never going to become as successful as this man became. And in fact, most urban residents are probably not ever going to become that successful as he became. But I, you know, do think that everyone's life is good, is, you know, their lifestyles are improving. You know, right now China's GDP is growing at such a rate that it's doubling every 7 years. And so everyone's lifestyle and standard of living is improving. And so I think at some point, these migrants who for so long have just sort of plowed through all these difficulties with this eating bitterness at all costs sort of mentality, at some point they're going to stop and start to reassess that mindset that they've had. And I think they're going to start to want more out of life and more of their labor, frankly. I mean, they want, you see this happening now with the younger migrants, they want, you know, higher salaries with better benefits, shorter working hours, closer to their families. And so this, I think it's a real challenge to China because the entire development model that they've been employing for the last 30 years has sort of relied on this sort of model of, you know, cheap labor in bad conditions and not really having to deal too much with how people are faring. But as migrants start to have more expectations, I think that that's China itself, the whole development model is also going to have to sort of remold itself.
My guest is Michelle Damon-Loyalka. She's a freelance journalist and author of the new book, Eating Bitterness, Stories from the Front Lines of China's Great Urban Migration. Join the conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372 or email us at think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in financial planning, web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. And you can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is freelance journalist Michelle Damon-Loyalka. Her new book is called Eating Bitterness, Stories from the Front Lines of China's Great Urban Migration. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or via email to think@kera.org. You know, Michelle, when you talk about the wave of the future perhaps being Chinese who are at least financially comfortable, looking to places, to things other than work to fulfill their lives and give them meaning, I have to think on the one hand, the Chinese government is delighted by this prospect that you have people independently making really good differences in the country. On the other hand, inevitably, when one is looking for meaning and finding religion and looking at social activism, suddenly there is a greater demand for political freedom and viability.
Yeah, I think that's definitely something that they are thinking about in the future and as in the future being a big obstacle. You know, gradually, I think the Chinese government is starting to relax things. For example, restrictions on religion. Gradually, over the last decade, they have relaxed a lot of those restrictions. And people, for example, now are allowed to have religion and to practice. But again, there's sort of government-sponsored churches and things like that. So it's China, I think, in the, when it does its reform, oftentimes it's kind of gradual. So again, for example, this household registration system, there's been a lot of talk in China that they should abolish that. But the government is, I feel, often hesitant to just sort of all at once relax restrictions. And so they're definitely relaxing things, but it's always a slow and gradual process, it seems.
Is there a sort of generation gap between young people who have no memory of the worst of the Cultural Revolution and people who did live through that and were told to reform their expectations for their own lives?
Oh, yeah. I think there's, I don't even know what to call it. I mean, I feel like just from one generation, it's like five or six generations in another place. It's such a gap sometimes. And the experiences of the older generation versus the younger generation. I remember one story. We had gone to visit a student. My husband was teaching classes there, and we had gone to visit one of his students at her home. She was 19-year-old college student, and she was talking about the goal of her life, and that, you know, the most important thing in life was to be comfortable. And, you know, so she was talking about getting a good job and doing the things she needed to be comfortable. And a little bit later in the day, her mom came home, and her mom hadn't heard this conversation, but her mom just started talking about the days when she had been sent to the countryside during the Cultural Revolution, and how at that time movies didn't ever come to the villages, but they would come to nearby cities, and they would oftentimes, when as youth they would hear that a movie was coming to a nearby city, they would get off of work in the evening and run. Sometimes, you know, 20 kilometers,
wow,
they would run to get to the movie, and then they would watch, and they would run back home through the countryside all night long. And as her mom told the story, she said, you know, now I have a DVD player right here in my living room. I can watch a movie anytime I want, but it really doesn't have any meaning to me. Mm. And so it was interesting for me to sort of hear these two stories, because the daughter thought being comfortable is the most important thing, but the mother is essentially saying, you know, now she's comfortable, but it's not... It doesn't, you know, sort of pull at our heartstrings as the way life was before.
Let's go back to the phones now. 1-800-933-5372 is our number. Melinda is on the line in Fort Worth. Hi, Melinda.
Hi. I'm thinking that they don't have, you know, like food stamps and Social Security and things that we have available here and health care. What happens to those people that, you know, don't have jobs and, you know, what prospects do they have? And I'll just listen offline. Thank
you. Cool.
That's a great question. I mean, I think that that is a kind of the reason why people have had to be so sort of able to endure difficulties, because there is largely not a big safety net for them. Especially for rural people, the main sort of Social Security that they have is their parcel of land. So, you know, when collectivization ended in China in the late 70s and early 80s, essentially what they did is every village took its communal land and divvied it up among, you know, the villagers. And that's essentially what happens today. The land, you receive the land at birth, but it's yours for life, but you don't have the right to sell the land. You can't let the land go fallow. And when you die, it's goes back to the village to be redistributed to the next generation. But other than that, it's yours for life, and it's really seen as a very important sort of safety net for people from the countryside, that at the very least they can always ensure that they can, you know, sustain their life. The main problem is, though, with this land is that by the time you divvy up all the arable land in China among, you know, 700-800 million rural residents, each person gets about a sixth of an acre. And so even if you assume a Chinese family of four, that's an area of land that's about 600 and sometimes smaller than the average American family farm. So obviously at that level, we're not talking about a viable livelihood. Farming in China is not really a viable livelihood then. It's more of a sustenance insurance plan. And so any family wanting to do more than just keep themselves fed, they generally need to send somebody to the cities.
A lot of the families you write about have more than one child. And is that a factor of the reality that it was always sort of different, the one-child policy was applied differently to rural areas?
Yeah, that's right. So the one-child policy in rural areas states that if your first child is a girl, then you're allowed to have a second child, mm-hmm, because there's this preference still in the countryside for boys. And so, so a lot of people have two. And in recent years, that policy has been relaxed as well. If you're an only child now, if both parents are only children, you're also allowed to have two children. And also, like in Beijing where I live now, there's a lot of people who are having two children, and that's because a lot of the way that this was controlled in the past was through your work unit. So if you had a government job and you had a second child, then you would lose your job, essentially. But now a lot of people are, you know, business people, they have their own jobs. And so if you have enough money to pay the fine associated with having a second child, then, you know, you're allowed to have a second child as long as you pay that fine. And so a lot of, you know, people in the urban areas who are wealthier, we see now having a second child as well.
How do the challenges and realities of migrant work affect the dynamics between men and women?
That's a good question. I think, you know, I've heard that there are villages where largely, mostly the men go out as migrants and the women stay back in the villages, but I think that's not the norm. I've met a lot of women also who are migrants. And it's interesting, in the part of China that I'm writing about, so in Western China, there's a stereotype that the men are kind of quite lazy. And so I did meet a lot of women who were very, very kind of have this single-minded focus on material prosperity and helping their kids to have better lives than they do. And the husbands would be a bit more relaxed and not so, you know, focused on material progress, but also in enjoying life. And I think that that's one thing that definitely you kind of see through the book, that a lot of times people, they don't have anything else in life. You know, the family of vegetable vendors that we talked about earlier, they essentially work every day from 3 a.m. until 9 p.m. So that's 18 hours a day, 7 days a week, at least 360 days a year for, I think, 12 years straight they've been doing that. So they don't really have a chance for other activities in their life. But other families I met, I would often see the wife kind of working really hard and the husband having this mindset that also we should, you know, have some enjoyment of life as well.
And in the beginning, that particular family that you described that are selling vegetables, they're living in essentially a garage.
That's right. So in this village of Ganjajai, this city village, when the farmers there built up their homes, they built it in such a way that they make very small rooms that they rent out to migrants. And so I think the average size of a migrant's home in these areas is about 8 square meters, which is essentially a bed with a little walkway around it. And so this family, they live in this one-car garage, no windows, no running water, no plumbing, no...
There's like a garage door that they used to get in.
Yeah, there's a garage door. It was a garage, in fact. I mean, it is a garage, but they lived there. And that's very common, this kind of very, very small and living condition. And that cost of that room, honestly, the cost of that room per month is about the cost of a pot of coffee in a coffee shop in the high-tech zone, which is right, you know, down the block. And so there's a real disparity. But the interesting thing, I think, you know, especially if we think in light of the whole sort of Apple Foxconn headlines that have been in the news recently regarding China's factories and the conditions in the factories, is, and this is not a justification for, you know, any abuses that happen there, but I think it's interesting to note that a lot of migrants who do their own businesses, they also choose to live in very similar conditions, you know, like I just said, 18 hours a day, 7 days a week is very common. Not that they're being forced to. This is their own choice. And, you know, for example, this family, they live in this one-car garage. You would think that they do this because they're just totally destitute. But, in fact, a lot of them, their goal is to save close to 100% of what they make as possible. And so it's not that they're, you know, that they're doing this because they're completely destitute, but that they want to really save for the future.
Do you mind talking, Michelle, about how you ended up moving to China and what kept you there?
Well, it's interesting. In 97, I was just out of college about 2 or 3 years, and I was running a small technical writing company in my home in Southern California. And I just happened to meet somebody who had an English school in China, and he was looking for teachers. And I, 24 at the time, I thought, hey, that sounds like a great adventure. And so he gave me 2 days to make the choice and 2 weeks to make the move.
Wow.
So I went kind of on a whim, and I thought I would go for, you know, a couple months and see what it's like, and then I would come back and continue with my business. But obviously that was 15 years ago, so my time in China has been much longer than I ever expected and much more interesting. And I think I was lucky because, you know, I went there and I had so many different experiences in China. In addition to teaching English, I wrote a textbook for kids. And that was used in rural kindergarten. Well, in kindergartens around Guangdong province, but especially kind of smaller, more rural townships. Hmm. And in one of these schools, one of these kindergartens, the principal invited me to stay an extra day and go with her back to a nearby village to visit her relatives. And so I went with her, and it was a beautiful village, and especially urban China can be so overly urbanized. I mean, there's no grass or trees sometimes. So having, after being in China for, I think at that time, about a year and a half, having this opportunity to go back to a village was a real treat. Mm-hmm. And in the evening, after sort of hiking for the day and enjoying the village, her relatives asked, how did I like it there? And I said, you know, I love it here. It's fantastic. And they said, oh, why don't you move here then? And I think, you know, I probably hadn't been in China long enough to realize that this wasn't a sincere invitation. It's just like a kind of making small talk. But so I said, sure, I would love to. And so they were surprised, but they were also very accommodating. And mm-hmm. so I ended up moving into this village where no foreigners had been before. And really quickly, I became like the local tourist attraction. Mm-hmm. People from neighboring villages would catch word that there was a foreigner living there and walk to my house and basically stand outside the windows looking in and making commentary on what they saw. So that I think was a really pivotal experience for me, because it got me thinking about China's sort of amazing economic transformation mm-hmm. from the point of view of the rural population. And then shortly after that, I moved to this high-tech zone and had this totally different experience of, you know, such fast-paced life. And that, again, made me think, how do people who come from the countryside as migrants, how do they feel when they come from such a radically different place into a place that's developing so quickly?
How long did it take for you to feel like you really had a handle on what China was? I mean, as a foreigner, you're learning the language and you're sort of understanding the culture. Was it like a decade before you thought, okay, I can write credibly about this?
That's a good question. I don't know if I feel confident yet to say I have a total handle on China. It's a really, it's a country very complex and also full of a lot of contradictions. But I guess, you know, I went back in 2004. I came back to the States to do a master's degree in journalism. I think after having been there 7 or 8 years and sort of having all these different experiences there, I felt ready. I think especially it was really useful to me not to go there as a journalist first, mm-hmm. because then I was able to just live and work there and make friends with people and sort of just listen to their stories and their life and the things that they were thinking about, and without any pressures to have to synthesize or analyze and think of how to share with other people. And then later to go back and to start to write about it. I think that was a really good kind of step.
The new book by freelance journalist Michelle Damon Loyalka is called Eating Bitterness, Stories from the Front Lines of China's Great Urban Migration. Michelle, it's been a fascinating hour. Thank you so much for spending it with us.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bellotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. And our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about Think, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcast at kera.org/think. If you've got comments, questions, or suggestions, send those to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.